Friends, it's Friday. What a week. Jahad and I were off last week, but we are back in action with Dr. Hamid Rashid, our friend and macroeconomist from the United Nations. In this episode, we start out with a recap of episode 11, where we explore the impact of monetary policy on the ownership economy. We recommend listening to that episode first before this deep dive on the tension between stability and efficiency in the design of decentralized finance protocols. Dr. Rashid walks us through a short history of the banking industry in the US to contextualize the current challenges in building decentralized financial systems. Hope you enjoy the episode.
Welcome, Hamid. Welcome back.
Thank you, Martin. Good to be here.
We're excited to have you back on the podcast. We're two major interest rates hike later from the last time you were here. And on the last podcast, we talked a little bit about Fed policy and how central bank policy has repercussions for the ownership economy. And maybe I'll just quickly summarize that discussion because I think it kicks off well the conversation on decentralized finance and what decentralized finance is actually trying to solve. And so in the last conversation, we essentially said, you brought up kind of and highlighted that we've been in this pro-asset environment for the last 12 years, where we have not been focused on as much as we need to on productivity growth and investment, and that liquidity environment that we've been in, the excess liquidity from the central bank buying up a bunch of or creating reserves and buying up a bunch of assets from commercial banks and then paying interest on not only required reserves but excess reserves did not actually have the policy impact that the governors of the central bank thought that it would. So what actually happened over the last 10 years is rather than more investment going into commercial activity, banks just ended up buying more securities. They lend it to other people. You saw increased financialization of the economy. At the same time, we saw a continuation over the past 10 years that we saw in the 2000s, where we had very little real wage growth. And the labor share of GDP is in the US is actually declining. So I guess to kind of tee up the conversation on DeFi, it would be interesting to get your perspective on the policy impact for interest rate in an interest rate rising environment on the two situations that we talked about on the last episode. One is what happens to the Fed's balance sheet when it has to pay investment on excess reserves when interest rates are going up. And then the second thing we talked about is what happens in emerging market in an environment like this. So I think this is a good place to kind of kick off the conversation.
All right. Thank you, Martin. And good morning. And I think I'm from New York. You raised some very interesting and interrelated questions. You know, interest rate is the price of money, and that affects and the dominant money in the global economy is US dollars. So interest rates on US dollar, when it goes up, it affects the price of every other asset globally. So it's a very globally integrated market. Unless you are not part of the global economy, some economies will not have that much effect if it's not integrated with the global economy. But the two questions that you raised, the first one is that what happens to Fed balance sheet and how does Fed square the circle? It has higher interest rates mean that it has its servicing cost goes up. It is holding basically some assets, and then that means it has to pay interest on those securities that they're holding. But interesting thing that a lot of people don't realize, the question that you need to answer is that who owns the Fed? Is Fed a self-owned entity or someone else owns Fed? If you look at the charter of the Fed is owned by the US Treasury. So any expenses that Fed incurs to service the security and any profit, net profit that Fed earns after its operating cost, it surrenders the entire the income, net income to the Treasury. So US Treasury. So US Treasury ultimately owns the Federal Reserve Board, which is the intermediary between the 12 Federal Reserve Banks and the US government. So assets are purchased by the US Federal Reserve Banks. Yeah, and you know, there are Federal Reserve Banks are privately owned. And they have a policymaking role through the FOMC. And you know the mechanism, they are represented in a Federal Open Market Committee, but government appoints some of the members of the Federal Reserve, the members of the Federal Reserve Board, and they're jointly represented in the FOMC. So the answer is that nothing happens, actually. That, to be very honest, the Fed just, the Treasury is paying interest to the Fed, And Fed is collecting that interest on the U.S. treasuries from the U.S. treasury. And after it's meeting its operating expenses, surrenders money back to the treasury. So it may sound very, why do we go through this whole hoopla? But this is the reality. You know, basically, that's how it is structured. But there's still some risk for Fed and the treasury. That one of the issues that if Fed holds these treasuries to the securities to maturity, what happens at maturity? So if Fed has to basically, at some point, the redemption question would come in, right? You know, if you had $5 trillion of securities and they all mature, at that point, if it is not rolled over, then the U.S. Treasury has to surrender for like $5 trillion hypothetically to the Fed. But where would Fed get a Treasury get the money from? You know, they have to issue new debt to pay for the old debt. Because what the Fed is collecting right now is not the principal. It's only collecting the interest. I know you look very confused, but they're collecting the interest. So interest is after meeting the expenses, it goes back to the treasury. But at some point, some of the securities would mature. At that point, unless they're rolled over, then treasury will have to issue new debts. And that's how actually treasury never, ever actually pays back the principals. It just rolls, it rolls over its debt. That's why debt is keeps growing. So there's so I asked that question to many senior economists about what happens if at some point the Fed writes off those claims on the U.S. Treasury, and how would that affect the balance sheet of everyone else? And maturity, if Fed decides to that it's going to cancel right off the debt owed by the Treasury to Fed, it can do it. And overall repercussion on the financial system would be somewhat puzzling, but we haven't figured out completely how the market would react to that situation. But it is very, very unlikely that it would ever come to it because, you know, as I said, this always rolled over. The treasury securities are always rolled over, so it's never fully redeemed. The face value is never fully redeemed. But that would, the one issue that would be is that if the Fed decides to write off on the face value of the debt, then it would affect the credibility of Fed. And that would be a highly risky move for Fed. Then everyone would believe that Fed takes, basically prints money. There's a traditional notion of Fed never prints money, actually. And it's all operations through the swap operation. But then there'll be an expectation that any debt that Fed would assume would be written off in the future time. So it's very highly inflationary. It will distort market pricing. So I don't think that would ever happen. But that's an option or a nuclear option that Fed can have. But that would be extremely destabilizing. And also, it will be very, very, like, you know, from a credibility point of view, it will be very costly for the Fed. The second
let me just kind of summarize that quickly before we keep going. So my understanding is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, as interest rates rise, the Fed's kind of costs of servicing and paying interest on excess reserves goes up fairly dramatically. And what has been a net positive in terms of paying into Treasury could actually become a deficit. Yeah. Is that wrong?
Yeah, no. But the thing is that Fed is paying interest on excess reserves, right? Now, excess reserves, what happens with the excess reserve? So the way that Fed operates the Fed balance sheet is a swap operation. And let me clarify that. What is a swap operation? So banks have liquidity, excess liquidity. They park that liquidity on the Fed balance sheet. And when Fed wants to buy securities from the bank, whether it's the U.S. Treasury, whether it's the Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac securities, what Fed does, Fed swaps the transaction, gives the liquidity, the excess reserve that banks had put on the Fed balance sheet. It goes back to the banks and Fed takes the security. Do you understand? And then Fed collects interest rate from the Treasury. Because now they're all Fannie Mae, because they are the debt holder. So, and that interest rate is used, the income from the on the earnings side is used to pay for the excess reserve that any of the residual excess reserve that Fed has on its balance sheet to pay the banks. You understand? So Fed is basically not losing money in any way. So it's just swapping the operation. So it has it swaps liquidity for security. Excess reserve balance goes down, or overall reserve balance goes down, but its balance of illiquid asset, the government securities, goes up. And government securities earn interest, and that interest is partly used to pay for the interest on excess reserves. So
right. So effectively, the Treasury in a rising interest rate environment, the Treasury is paying more to the Fed, or one of the housing lenders is paying more to the Fed, and the Fed is just passing that on to commercial banks.
Yeah.
And this whole philosophy, this whole kind of system, was created because the banks lobbied to say that they had to pay on excess reserves.
Yes, that is absolutely true. 2006 is before the financial crisis. As if banks were not very profitable at that time, they lobbied with Congress very hard, and they said this is a tax on the banking system. And they, not only on excess reserve, they actually on required reserve as well. There's a provision to pay interest rates right now. And few countries did that. The idea was that this is idle money. It has an opportunity cost, and Fed should not hold that money without compensating the banks.
So right, but the opportunity cost was to go towards lending or investing in the real economy. And what's actually happened is this financialization, and it's led to asset price increases. Yeah. So the whole rationale for lobbying for this 10 years later was not actually done.
Yeah, and whole lobbying became counterproductive, because that then what happened is that any Fed had less incentives to raise the reserve requirements. You kind of increase the excess reserve requirement. Excess reserve requirement, so there's no requirement for excess reserve. So basically, Fed would rather keep the money on the bank's balance sheet and not pay interest rates if they can. And then a bank would plow that money back to financial market, buying financial assets, as opposed to in real investment. So that is the distortion that happened. And it was fast-tracked in 2008. To pay the interest rate on excess reserve, because banks at that time said, look, it was supposed to kick in 2009 or 2010, this new legislation of paying interest on excess reserve. But after the financial crisis, banks said, look, you know, we are very unprofitable right now. We need we need to be compensated for any money we put on the Fed's balance sheet. And that's when they fast forwarded, and it came into effect in 2008. Yeah.
Yeah. And so just to put these numbers in perspective, you know, $700 billion is spent on Medicare every year in the US, $700 billion is spent on, you know, the largest military spend in the world. I think the next after us is China at one third of that, right? And just this one policy requires Treasury to pay over $100 billion a year more to the banks, essentially moving that money through the Fed. So this is a similar effect in emerging markets when we move into this kind of rising interest rate environment. What's the effect in emerging markets?
I think the effects on the emerging markets are much clearer. They are the receiving end when the interest rate goes up. Yeah, if you go back to macro 101, is that uncovered interest rate parity. So what would happen is that their exchange rate has to depreciate. So if you look at, in order to, unless they raise interest rates, their exchange rate has to adjust downward, because you can't have arbitrage between two exchange rates through the interest rate differentials. So if you then, the most of the currencies, if you see the dollar appreciated significantly over the last, say, you know, since COVID, and especially in the last 3 months, dollar strengthened vis-a-vis all major currencies, especially euro, but also other currencies. And that is the net effect of rising interest rates in the US. It has a second order effect, or first order effect is that rising interest rates, US dollar interest rates, increases the debt servicing cost on dollar denominated assets or liabilities. For emerging markets, most 80% of the debt are in external debt are in US dollars, more than 80% actually. So their debt servicing cost goes up, number one. Then their import cost goes up. They also have, you know, with exchange rate falling, they have, their import bill goes up. That's another effect. And then also the other impact that you have is that capital outflow, because this is a major risk for the developing countries or the emerging markets, for that matter. When the return on dollar in terms of interest rates goes up, the money flows in the opposite direction. And that happens exactly the time when they need the money the most. So liquidity dries up very quickly. And that is also a challenge. And their response, central banks typically respond with emerging markets, they typically keep up with the Fed they raise interest rates as well. And that is a sort of a, you know, I would say a self-defeating process. By raising interest rates, they protect their exchange rate. Most of the countries now, I think one third of the countries, the emerging and developing markets, they've raised interest rates in the last 6 months. And that is affecting their competitiveness. That's affecting their exports. They're affecting their economic growth because domestic investment goes down when there's no reason for them to raise interest rates for their domestic fundamentals. Because in the U.S., the idea is that inflation is very high, but that inflation is in developing countries is mostly imported inflation, partly because their exchange rate takes a hit. So if you look at all the correlation, all the spillover effects of Fed raising rates, it severely affects the emerging markets. And they have no choice but to raise interest rates and slow down their economy when they don't need to. The inflationary pressure in emerging markets. They've been living with high inflation. A 13% inflation in Latin America is not unprecedented or not destabilizing. And they have, unless it's a triple-digit inflation, many countries shrug them off. But right now, both in Africa, average inflation is over double-digit, low double-digit, 11, 12%. And inflation in Latin America is also very high. Only bright spot is East Asia, low inflation. And because of high inflation, but this is not high inflation but in the sense of what we see high inflation in advanced economies. But despite that tolerable level of inflation, they're raising interest rates very aggressively. Brazil raised interest rates very early on, and that is something they have to do because they have to protect their exchange rate. They don't want exchange rate to fall too quickly, and it's a balancing act. In one hand, if they don't allow the exchange rate to stabilize, then the debt servicing cost goes up significantly. You know, a 50% depreciation of the exchange rate increases your debt servicing cost by similar proportion. But the other side of the equation is that as you raise interest rates, then your export takes a hit. So if you allow that interest, the exchange rate to depreciate, your export could go up, but export elasticity may not be big enough. So the central banks don't want to wait for the export to pick or take respond to that interest rate, their exchange rate devaluation or depreciation. So they immediately raise interest rates, and that basically makes their exchange rate even more overvalued. Multiple effects for emerging markets, yeah.
Okay, so this environment now is where a whole bunch of entrepreneurs and investors are coming in and say, we just want to disintermediate this. We want to essentially create a set of different composable kind of money Legos through decentralized finance. And so from your perspective, what is DeFi actually trying to solve, and what are the implications for the ownership economy?
Yeah, I think DeFi has a noble objective. Like most innovations begin with noble objective to solve a problem of market inefficiency. Market is inefficient in terms of allocation of capital. So idea is that some people can create asset, but they may not need all the asset that they create. So they should be able to send it or give it to the best use. So those who have scarcity of assets or capital, they can utilize it and give them return. This is the whole concept of savers versus investors, the gap, saving investment gap. So some people are good at creating assets, but they're not as good as using those assets or using those capital that they create. But this is, if you begin with the noble objective, so it's about improving efficiency. And one of the efficiency, the low-hanging fruit in the DeFi environment is that inefficiency in the payment system. Payment system still, you make a payment to a party, and at the lag between when you click and when someone else receives the payment. Of course, there are Venmos and Zelle and others. There are some improvement, but still in the large scale, still the payment system is highly centralized. And it takes a lot of time, a day or two. And that's a dead weight loss for an economy. So I should be able to get paid right away if I have sold something to you. And why should I wait 3 days? And I could use that money efficiently. So that's one of the ideas that DeFi wants to solve, the inefficiency in the payment system. And other inefficiency is that basically, when you have many financial intermediaries and many basically the due diligence and all the process of allocation, it is very intensive. So credit rationing can be very, very intensive, and a lot of people don't get access to credit in a formal financial market. And that's why we had in the 90s, where I come from, microfinance was the word, the buzzword. You know, microfinance would solve all the problems because we're basically creating a credit system without collateral. It had some benefits. It had, I would not completely rule out all the benefits of microfinance, but it also came with a lot of cost. So microfinance solved some of the problems of credit worthiness or credit to access to credit for the poor and marginalized communities and households. And this is, again, DeFi is also trying to expand access to credit for people who are not in the traditional sense credit worthy, or you know, you may not get the credit that you want at the right time, at the right place. So these are, again, a very noble sort of objective, improving payment efficiency, improving capital allocation efficiency. These are all noble objectives. But efficiency, like anything else, is not a free lunch. What you give up to gain the efficiency that you want to seek. And this is probably the discussion that we want to have, is that the trade-off between efficiency and stability. And this is where the crux of the issue is, that we might be very efficient in allocating, you know, resources very quickly, or making payments as quickly as possible in an instant. So you have that, you know, high frequency trading kind of scenario where you have very, very quick millisecond turnovers. But you have to think about how it affects stability. And for that, we have a lot of lessons from the past, because efficiency is not a panacea. You have to look at the cost and benefits of an efficient outcome. And I'm not even going to the equity issue right now. I'm just talking about, you know, even within the efficiency domain, how do you make sure the efficiency doesn't lead to instability? And I don't know whether last time I spoke about it, you know, we had a history of banking system in the US that experimented with many, many models. I think it started off with the debate between Jefferson and Hamilton and whether US needs a central bank or not. And the Jeffersonian views of the world was that we don't need a centralized monetary system in the new republic. Why? Because exactly what Martin, you started off saying, that, you know, the elite capture, you know, that, you know, if you have a central bank, people sitting in New York, at that time, New York still was the financial center of the United States, budding United States. And they said, look, no, Hamilton's of the world. And Hamilton did actually a lot of shady things, to be very honest. You know, he didn't get a banking license. Then he created a water, just an aside, he created a water distribution company. And then he, basically, that company was raising capital, and then he converted that into a bank. And the modern Chase Bank has its lineage to the bank that Hamilton created. So there were some real concerns about unscrupulous financial players dominating. So the view was that the U.S. didn't need a central bank. The new republic should be decentralized. Everything should be at the community level. But Hamilton won the battle, early battle, as you know. I encourage everyone to watch Hamilton. I think play was pretty accurately, historical accuracy is pretty good. So the idea that a bank was created as a trade-off, a central bank, but it had a very finite charter. I'm sorry, I'm taking a long time to give you the context.
No problem.
But then the first charter ended. And then the second United States Bank was created, and you know the trade-offs. There were a lot of underhand dealings when the bank was created. The first bank was created with entirely foreign capital. Foreign capital was basically British capital. So when the charter renewal came, they didn't want to renew the charter because they said, look at this undue influence in the U.S. economy by our former masters. So they have left the control, but this is exactly what now U.S. does to the rest of the world in many ways. So the idea is that then when the second bank was created, second bank of the United States, a new charter was given. At that time, they limited foreign involvement in the sense that you could buy stocks of the second bank of the United States, foreigners, but you didn't have the voting rights. So you couldn't, of the central bank of the United States, second one. But then a reincarnate Jefferson, Andrew Jackson, when his term came, he ran on a platform that he would not renew the that mandate. Of the mandate was expiring in 1836-37. He said he's not going to renew and he's going to veto, and he vetoed. So there was no central bank in the United States between 1836 and 1914. So this whole period, a U.S. almost 100 years, U.S. didn't have a central bank. So everything was done at the local level. But coming back to my story, or the story that we are decentralization, a decentralized financial system, an extreme period between that, during that time, was between 1836-37 until 1863-64, just about 30-year period, when the National Banking Act was enacted by Lincoln. Again, I don't want to go into that digression. It's a very timely act. But it was, this is the period, for 30-year period, was called the free banking era in the U.S., United States. And this is very, very sort of important for us to learn the lesson from that era, that 30-year period. Every commercial bank in the United States was allowed to create their own money, money that was in circulation. Where, of course, banks, commercial banks, create money through credit. But we're not talking about credit. We're talking about bank notes. And there were about 1,200 bank notes in circulation in the U.S. So you could have dollars issued by a bank in Georgia and a bank in Tennessee. And these dollars would be traded like securities to some extent, similar to the bitcoins and other. So face value of the dollar would be $10. A Georgia bank issued a $10 bill, but it could be traded at $7 in New York. Or a note issued in Boston, a Boston bank would be, a $10 note would be traded above par in the South. So depending on who the credibility of the bank and the credibility of the issuer, you had a situation where basically there's no uniform dollar. $1 was not $1 everywhere. So there were different, all dollars were not created equal. And it was a huge mess at that time, because a financial system had huge turmoil, huge banks would come and go. People would lose their deposits overnight. There's all fear. And it was at that time called basically wildcat banking. The reason wildcat banking, it was called wildcat banking era, because often you create open a bank in a place where there were no people, there were only wildcats. The reason you would create a bank so far in a remote area in Nebraska or in Dakotas, Dakotas became very famous for opening banks, you know, very inaccessible. And because you wanted to be as far away from supervisors. Because in order to issue, open a bank, bank charters are all state-level charters. There's no federal charter for banks because there was no federal authority. OCC was created in 1864, Office of Comptroller of Currency. And before that, it was all basically state legislator, not even state banking supervisor. State, Michigan state legislator or South Dakota state legislator, they would issue a banking license. So idea was that anybody could get a license if they had enough political influence. So, and you'd create a bank under the assumption that you'd have some paid-in capital. And this paid-in capital is what a banking supervisor at the state level would supervise, like how much gold you have in your deposit. And based on that, you'd be allowed to issue. The reason that they would set up the banks as remote as possible, whenever they would hear that a supervisor is coming to supervise your gold reserves, they would basically coordinate with other banks and try to borrow from each other to show that they have enough gold. So that was the idea. So, long story short, this was a dismal failure. It didn't work. I'm not saying that a DeFi would not work. DeFi would work, but if you have the right regulatory framework and right regulatory and environment in place and enforcement in place. So the challenge in the DeFi environment is that, I think I alluded to it last time, is that whenever you're working with other people's money, meaning that if you have in a DeFi environment, frictionless environment, you know, you're creating asset, and you want to loan that asset to someone else. But you yourself is not the only creator. You're also pulling assets created by other people. In the banking system, we solve that problem by, first of all, making sure that you have a paid-in capital. You have some set-aside, undisputed asset. So think about allowing those wildcat banks to meet their reserve requirements with the note that they printed. Would you allow that? You wouldn't have allowed that. And this is the kind of situation we are in the DeFi world. We want to say, okay, we are creating, you know, a digital coin, and that would be our asset base. We'll keep it aside. But that asset is highly volatile. It's not gold. it's not, I'm not promoting gold standard here, but I'm saying that a neutral asset, asset that would not be highly correlated to the asset that you are bringing in or your capital.
I mean, I guess, let me stop you here for 1 second and summarize, and then let's unpack this a little bit. All right. So like so you mentioned a few things at the beginning of this on the rationale for DeFi. So one was we've got too much centralized control. So some statistics on that. We've gone from the four largest banks in the United States owning 15% of the market in 1984. We're now at 45%. There's, you know, limited access to financial services. You've got about 1.7, 1.8 billion people that are still unbanked. And then capital efficiency, right? And so, you know, we pay, you know, we mentioned kind of remittances to places around the world. I remember when I was in Bangladesh, even 5 or 6 years ago, it was 10, 11%. Remittance fees consistently are 5 to 7%. Credit card fees haven't come down in 50 years at 3%. And there's all these challenges around microtransactions. And so I think like before we get into the conversation on the backing and collateralization of DeFi, because I think it ties into what you were just talking about with the wildcat banking error. Maybe, Jahad, you could just kind of interject here and talk about very briefly the different money Legos in DeFi to give us a broad overview so that it cues up the conversation on stable coins.
Definitely. It's funny. I think some of it maps to a lot of what Hamid was saying, because honestly, I don't know if y'all can't see my face, but while Hamid was talking about the wildcat bank era and the one, you know, kind of preceding it in that 100 years leading up to, I believe, was 1914 or 1916, it honestly sounds like we had a federated and decentralized approach to finance, you know, minus electrons for a while, right? That's pretty interesting. That's the thing that I would love to come back to at some point and just see, like, you know, what did we learn from that, from history? Because this is the thing we constantly see in this space, is that people, innovators, whatever you want to call them, they're just coming in and doing stuff without looking at the history of people who may have thought about doing this particular thing already, right? So that was fascinating. Thanks for that. But as far as, you know, DeFi, I want to keep things super simple and high level. I know, I mean, you seem to be somewhat, you know, well-versed in what it is and what it's trying to achieve, but I think just for listeners in general, right? Like, what is decentralized finance? You can think of it as anything that facilitates peer-to-peer transfer of value. And then if you want to get more concrete about that, a non-custodial, permissionless, openly auditable, and sometimes pseudonymous financial architecture, right? That basically facilitates these peer-to-peer transactions. And so what does it materialize in? You know, what does that look like? People think about, well, decentralized finance. Honestly, the regular financial system is so opaque that it's like, you know, what does it actually do? What happens to my money in a bank account, all the way up to the macro level that we've covered? It's all pretty difficult to unpack for the average person, but you can think of a few things here, right? So one of the really common things in decentralized finance that actually differs radically from what's available in some of the regular system is automated market makers, right? So automated market makers, the word, the concept does exist, right? Like if you look at something like interactive brokers with the you know, that's been around since the 70s, facilitating high frequency trading. The way it's done is interesting, right? Is that an automated market maker uses a constant product formula and adjusts liquidity pools to ensure that trades can always happen. It's not doing anything with an order book, right? It's like me, I'm not going there and saying, I would like to buy 10 Ethereum. And then there's not an order book that goes, well, who's willing to sell it for that amount and then matching that up. It's actually just facilitating the transaction immediately with liquidity pools and adjusting prices dynamically and taking in inputs from everywhere, right? So it's pretty fascinating on that front. And by everywhere being centralized exchanges, decentralized exchanges, everything, any data can get access to, right? That's kind of the promise of this, is to say, how can we integrate everyone's input into the system and have some way to market make? You know, there's some other things as well, which, you know, I mean, I'm sure you're well-versed in, but, you know, over-collateralized loans, flash loans. So basically protocols that say, hey, if we don't actually care who you are, but if you can provide X collateral, we'll give you 80% of that in a different currency that you can go use today, right? And facilitate the transaction, press this button, it's yours. And stable coins we'll get to. It's a huge subject, but it comes right back around to what you were saying. The quick thing to know about stable coins is, I think it goes kind of to what you were saying with reserves, right? So like, you don't want to be able to say, hey, we launched a new token. Maybe it's the token that represents my automated market maker, Uniswap. I'm going to collateralize the liquidity pools that I'm using to swap everything with in Uni as well, right? You'd actually want them to be in some commonly accepted currency that if anyone had to have some kind of bank run for whatever reason, they could get their money and get paid out in something that represents everyday currency that they could use, right? And stablecoins kind of address that problem, this medium exchange problem across all of DeFi. And we'll get into the various types. That's a different conversation. And then lastly, you have other things that get really esoteric for most people, but, you know, derivatives platforms, staking derivatives, things that basically enable you to bet on the future with current positions you have today, which for the most vast majority of humanity is not something they even need to consider doing. Some portfolio manager will do it on their behalf. And then where it gets interesting is some of the things that are not possible within the current financial system. So like privacy preserving mixers for transactions. So decentralized finance, that's becoming one of its key. And, you know, there are some things to indicate here before I toss it back to you folks. But, you know, when you hear privacy preserving at every conference I've been to, even regular amongst people who are in the regular centralized financial system, their first concern is crimes. And I think it's a fair concern, right? Because when you have privacy and you have other things entering the privacy preserving technologies, some of these are going to enable financial crime, right? And that's let's just state that, you know, it's out there. At the same time, there are other use cases for privacy, right? So like, I don't need to go through too many of these, but I come from Afghanistan. If you're escaping Afghanistan in August last year and you wanted to find a way to actually not reveal your cards, not participate in an open bank run, privacy preserving technologies might be an interesting thing for you, you know, across all, if you're under the boot of an authoritarian government, you know, that there's real world examples of that, right? Where it's actually useful. If you are suddenly under the boot of some state policy that you did not even know you were against, right? That's the thing, like, you know, you could go navigate your daily life and break any number of rules or laws that you didn't know exist. So that's kind of the spirit of that. But of course, the execution is a bit different in real life. So that's a quick overview. Hopefully, I think that kind of opens up the conversation for.
Yeah, I think it's great. And it goes back, I think if we focus in on stable coins then and really get into, Hamid, what you were talking about. So when we talk about DeFi, we talk about the risks of DeFi, it's important to state the real risk here is around a lack of, there's a bunch of risks and we can talk about each of those risks. There's technical risks, there's economic risks. But when we're talking about the kind of wildcat banking era where anyone could establish their own bank and print their own money, it seems to me what you're talking about here, Hamid, is that there's no collateralization, right? So effectively, the reason why, even though the US government has moved off of the gold standard over the course of the last 40 years, there's still a lot of demand for US dollars because people pay taxes in it. You know, trade is exchanged in dollars. There's debt denominated in USD. And then you have the full backing of the US military to enforce that, right? And the government as well domestically. So walk us through kind of the parallels between this era for these 30 years in the 1800s to where we are today and your concerns from kind of a moving too far towards efficiency and too far away from stability.
Yeah, I think this is, I would pick two things Jahad mentioned. And one is that peer-to-peer framework, that's probably the crux of the model that we have identified, that, you know, X and Y, they'll directly interact without an intermediary basically telling this. They'll create market and there'll be demand and there'll be supply. And then the matching would take place instantaneously. If there's a demand for some funds and somebody's willing to provide their fund, that will take place without a regulated centralized system. And that is what I understand is the model. But this is exactly, think about the wildcat banking in an exponential sort of setup. So if you multiply, even in wildcat banking, there was a custodial role. Somebody was playing a dubious custodial role, but there was a custodial capacity there that somebody would say, look, I'm going to issue the credit or a liability, and I'll be matching that liability with the fake gold or whatever gold I have. So there was some level of a custodial responsibility, like, or a responsibility of whatever you call it, that the idea that you'd be able to match that liability. Now, in this DeFi world, we're expecting millions of participants, you know, from across the world. They all possess perfect information about each other, about their motivation, about a market where highly efficient market. Everyone knows about whether the other person is credit worthy or not, whether they have been honest about their past promises, whether they've met their obligation, the assets that they hold or about to lend are of X quality. So this is, again, based on a perfect information on both the sides of those who are lenders and those who are on the side of the borrowers. But as we know, there's no perfect information. There's a huge information asymmetry about, even in a decentralized market, that would matter a lot. So the basic question that you have to ask is that, how do you prevent fraud? How do you prevent at the basically saying, okay, look, this is what I'm lending. This is the value of my asset that I'm lending you. And this is what you pay me back plus X some interest. So you may borrow, say, a stable coin or whatever, or a Bitcoin or some other digital, which is highly volatile in price. And its quality of that asset, nobody's guaranteeing. There's no underwriter who's saying this is the true value. So it's there's a valuation challenge there. It's a valuation risk is the issue. So the idea that what are we trying to solve? In a DeFi world, I think if you're talking about liquidity problems or liquidity needs of people, maybe you can meet it very quickly with this kind of liquidity provision. But liquidity is a necessary condition for investment. Can we have longer term investments with the DeFi model that we have? And this is where the question of stability comes. And this is a question, I'll fast forward to the great 1929 crash and what we learned from that. The idea was, before 1929, the US banks, by the time Fed was already there, Fed started enforcing its regulations. But one thing that happened at that time before 1929 crash, banks were paying interest rates on every kind of deposits, including overnight deposits, okay? And that question that came after the crisis, the lesson that we learned from the crisis, how were banks making money on overnight if they're paying interest on overnight? Because this is an on-demand money that you put the money and you can come, and next day said, I want the money back. But they were offering 5%, 7%, 6%, 7%, 8% interest rates on that overnight deposits that were highly unstable. And the thing was that they were plowing that money into highly speculative, and banks were competing on the overnight funds, and they're putting all the money in the stock market in New York and betting on the stocks. And that was giving them for a long time a return that was able to they give it back to the depositors. So one of the things that happened with Glass-Steagall, which is known as Regulation Q, first thing they did, and it's probably the most important and interesting thing that Regulation Q did, is that they prohibited banks from paying any interest on short-term deposits, deposits that are not stable, that you cannot offer any kind of interest or remuneration. You're just giving a liquidity support for the fact. Right. You don't want to hold the money yourself. You're putting the money in the bank.
Yeah, I think that's a great spot to call out to that what you just described. Yeah. This is a great example of what's happening in some of the markets in decentralized finance. People are... No, I would love if I could just take the last 45-second clip you just put together and send it to the founders of Celsius and Voyager and everyone else who's in. I don't know if you've heard of this.
I'm more from the guy from the past. So I'm trying to understand what's happening in the DeFi world.
Let me just break it down for you super quickly. So you have these centralized entities that have kind of been masquerading as decentralized finance providers. They're doing exactly what you said. They're giant platforms that aggregate customer capital. So 1.5 million customers in the case of Celsius. And they are then using all of that aggregated capital to make bets on DeFi protocols that are offering honestly unsustainable APR out there in the market, right? And they're building these giant, scripts, farms, engineers, all these people coming together and saying, okay, allocate this much to that pool, allocate that much to the other one. And then as customers come in and say, hey, I want to take my money out, which like you said, they can do this at any time. It's literally, almost literally the same thing, right? I can come and say, I'll put my 50K in here today. I'll leave it in here for a week. I want it back next week, with my 12% APR. And so they basically they got caught. Because a whole bunch of giant collapses of, $70 billion in Terra. Terra was one of the ones offering 20% APR. They basically went to zero in the matter of a week. And so now Celsius and other of these centralized providers have to then call funds back from that are deployed to pay back customers. And suddenly they don't have any of those funds anymore, yeah. Right? Because they went like this. So it's like almost step for step, exactly what you said.
And if you look at the Regulation Q history, this is a regulation banks hated. And finally, by the 1980s, there are a lot of attacks on Regulation Q. By 1994, it was completely repealed. So Glass-Steagall was completely repealed by 1994, 95. And that was the stability argument that was put in place that, you know, you have to make sure that you don't encourage speculative activities with other people's money. You can speculate as much as you want with your own money. There's no problem with that. But the problem is that when you have take money and you promise that you'd pay them an APR of, say, 10%, 12%, well, how would you make that money? And how would you do that? So there'll be, again, the question of long-term investment versus short-term speculation. You know, so you cannot have long-term investments. And there are many other things that I can talk about, the what Glass-Steagall did to stabilize, to create stability in the financial system. And U.S. financial system was highly stable for almost 70 years. Between, except for S&L crisis in the late 80s, it is overall a very stable financial system for a long period of time until we started repealing Glass-Steagall one by one. And there were many other provisions of Glass-Steagall that had actually a very important stability concerns. Another issue that, and I'll come back to the bigger discussion. Another part of the, it was actually pre-Glass-Steagall, but it was still very effective. Like, for example, restrictions on branching. So banks were not allowed to create branches across states. There's no interstate banking at that time. And partly because ideas that flow of funds, funds would flow very quickly from one branch to the other. Even some of the states, the state of Oregon and state of Washington, they wouldn't even allow branching of, so you had one bank in one town. You couldn't have a, another branch in a different town. They're afraid that money would flow very quickly in and out of branches, and that would create financial instability. So now, in an exponential, in a very different environment where you have money can flow instantaneously thanks to our digital advances, just think about what would happen to stability. And this is the issue. And without any kind of collateral or the reserve requirement or capital requirement, but there are two parts to it. Capital requirement is, you have to understand, is something that you put in upfront before you start the business. Okay, this is the money. And this capital is denominated in an asset that is an asset which is considered asset by everyone else. Like, you know, there's a general agreement, a consensus about the quality of that asset. Gold or SDR or US dollar, you create an asset pool, and then you start the business of taking other people's money. And then when you take other people's money, then you have another layer of protection, that you are putting some money away in a reserve fund so that if there's no bank run, so you can meet all the ongoing obligations of paying the customers if they want to withdraw the money. So there's a second layer of protection that you have. The third layer of protection, even that was not enough, you have the deposit insurance. So you have a deposit insurance that makes sure that, you know, even if, you know, if your reserves are not enough to cover all your obligations and you have many bad bets, IndyMac, for example, or other bank failures, 2008, 2009, exactly. The idea that you have deposit insurance that provides a third layer of protection. And then on top of that, you have extensive supervisory functions, a capital adequacy test, stress test, and all these requirements are met to make sure. So if humans are angels, DeFi would work perfectly, you know, but we are not angels. We have greed.
This is a good spot, actually.
We are motivated by, you know, self-interest only.
Yeah, for sure.
We are almost always oblivious about the externalities of our action. That's the third important point, because, you know, we don't care about what happens to others. So long it is, you know. So there are a lot of externalities that you have to deal with in DeFi environment. In the peer-to-peer thing, you can trust someone. You can trust me fully. I can trust you fully. But there can be a huge negative externality for the rest of the people who are not party to this transaction.
Well, so, I think this is a really good spot, actually, to kind of make, to revisit the, this is a great thing to put in context, the what happened with Celsius and with Voyager and these other things. It's important to note that when we were, you know, a while back, 20 minutes ago, when we were talking about what are kind of the pillars of DeFi, what is the spirit of the space, what is it shooting for? Those firms, and they are firms, they're not really indicative of DeFi in any way. I would actually say that they're really more like a firm pre-Glass-Steagall operating without any of the restrictions. When you look at their marketing and the products they were offering, they essentially wanted to position themselves as banks with the safety of a bank, with none of the attendant risk management practices, essentially. Yeah. Nothing in place for collateral, nothing in place for deposit insurance, nothing whatsoever. And so now you have them, you know, they're also not transparent, they're not peer-to-peer, nothing like that, right? So I think, like, what's encouraging to see, and like, what, you know, this is a system with no, like you said, with, I'm talking now about DeFi itself, because those really firms aren't really DeFi in spirit in any way. It's interesting to see what would then needs to happen to provide that same kind of stability to a DeFi system, right? Because like what the situation would be a really interesting parallel and test would be, and it's happened a couple times, but it's not big enough to matter, right? We're not talking about, we lost an entity the size of Layman when Terra Luna went down, $70 billion exploded, and nothing in this decentralized finance ecosystem really, there's no contagion, really. Yeah. The contagion affected the centralized entities like Voyager and these other folks. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see over time, right? If these risk management practices, the three tiers you kind of went through there, could in a meaningful way be applied to DeFi itself. Because I think that's a really good point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's also, I mean, I think there's a subtlety to what you're saying, right? Because there's a difference between, say, Bitcoin, where we are collectively deluded, right? That this, you know, machine for creating emissions, right, is going to increase in value because of a fixed money supply. And that, like, there's a collective delusion there that, and there's really nothing underpinning the system except collective belief in the system itself. And then there is kind of a stable coin, right? And what you're saying, what I hear you saying is that with a stable coin, you might be more comfortable with a digital dollar, a digital stable coin, as long as it's backed and over collateralized with enough, whether it's gold or other currencies or other crypto, et cetera. And my understanding of what the folks at Terra were trying to do when they were offering 20% return on Anchor is they were just trying to attract as much capital as possible. Then the interest rate environment adjusted on them, and then they couldn't diversify into other coins fast enough to be able to keep the whole kind of Ponzi scheme going. Yeah. But Hamid, are you kind of against the whole market in the sense that all of this is based on kind of digital diamond with Bitcoin and there's nothing underpinning Bitcoin except maybe the US government?
I'm definitely not against DeFi. I think that's the future. And I think with the traditional banking model that we had, it needs an alternative model. And technology would play a very important role. In fact, you know, very early on, when we banking, the 1,000 years of banking history that we have, banks have evolved over time. Financial intermediation have evolved over time. But the question is that when you create, so the, if you look at M2, money supply, you know, the biggest part of money supply is not the liquid money, it's the deposits, and that are calculated in M2. So here, now, if you want to have the money creation for mechanism without giving up completely its decentralized feature, because you definitely need decentralized, you know, environment for the reason that, you know, financial inclusion to make it more efficient, more equitable, all of that can be built in. But let's bear in mind that, you know, with all the regulatory trappings and all the regulatory oversight, still we had so many banking problems the last 200 years in the US. And one after another, we had innovations. Still, we couldn't avoid the Lehman crisis and the global financial crisis. And we are constantly experimenting from a regulatory point of view. And regulations are often behind the curve. You know, they're always a catching up thing. In the DeFi world, there's a benign negligence that somehow things would sort out themselves, you know, but it or not. And Jahid is right that, you know, we didn't have a contagion. But it's not because they're sort of two parallel universes. They're not really intersecting very well. But contagion will start when it will become more mainstream. So the future that I see is that it would become gradually more mainstream. And in the process, if you look at people, we had thousands of banks, you know, banks, number of banks that when US is still the number of banks in the US is way higher than any other country in the world on a per capita basis. But also, bank failures are very common. So in the DeFi world, also, you'll have tremendous amount of bank failures. The analogy that I like is that in the turn of the century, not in the financial system, but turn of the last century, US auto industry, everybody wanted to be an automaker. After Henry Ford came up with his the first car, commercially viable car, every garage in the US, they were building a car company. Ultimately, three or four survived. And same would happen as much as we love decentralized world. But market efficiency also, there's in some functions, there's always a natural monopoly. And in this world also, you'll find a natural monopoly emerging over time. And some of them would become more credit trustworthy. And that the transition, and when you gain more trust, your transaction cost goes down. You don't have to offer 12%. If an APR or 20% APR, those who are offering 20% APR, if I am their customer, I would immediately lose all trust in them. because that's the signal that average customers don't understand. But if you're an economist and if you're a serious player in the market, say, look, if you're offering 20%, you have to be a Ponzi scheme. You are not
absolutely
credible.
Absolutely. So,
and that's and signaling.
And one thing too to point out to make sure, just so I'm not misquoted, not that you're misquoting me, I just wasn't clear. It's there definitely was contagion to decentralized finance, but ultimately it didn't matter because all of those positions were over-collateralized. So smart contracts just liquidated them all and we all moved on with our lives. Yeah. Some of us took 20 to 30% hits, but that's just what it is, right? But the real contagion that you can't have under smart contracts inside of these, you know, these fake neobanks like Celsius, they had no choice, right? Yeah. They just got ruined.
Yeah, exactly. No, I think definitely, and we would see contagions, we'll see a more widespread effect. I think still the growing pains, we're going through the growing pains right now, and we don't have an equilibrium point yet. And two parallel universes exist right now. I think they will at some point sort of not merge, but it will become more interconnected. And that's when, if they're not done, regulated properly, that's when you'd see more risks for average person, yeah.
Well, so I guess like maybe where we could end is you're thinking on how kind of the anonymous kind of features within DeFi will butt up against kind of the regulatory environment, right? Because effectively you've got this trade-off between the legal responsibility of these systems versus accountability. So at least when we had the repeal of Glass-Steagall and you had kind of commercial banks and investment banks, and there was no longer kind of a firewall between them, at least we knew who the equity holders were. At least we understood the rules of the system. They could be hauled in front of the judiciary or Congress to testify after they had led to, you know, a collapse, and maybe nothing would happen to them and they would still have their nice houses in Greenwich, but we knew who they were, right? In this system, we've essentially created a legal environment where for something to be decentralized, there can't be any actor behind it that is essentially representing the system. Otherwise, it breaks the Howey test, it's the security, and all these platforms are based on governance tokens that try to get around securities, right? And so how do you see that evolving over time? Like, where do you see accountability coming up within DeFi? And how do we maintain the decentralized nature of this new innovation while at the same time having accountability and legal responsibility in the system as more and more assets are traded on these platforms?
Yeah, I think what we need to basically, for same kind of activity, we need to have same kind of regulation. If you are taking deposits, whether it's a digital deposit or digital coins, or whether you are taking deposits of gold or deposits of US dollars, deposit taking responsibility should be treated across the board with the same regulatory framework. And that's fundamental for, otherwise you create regulatory arbitrage opportunities. Right now, in the DeFi world, some of the rules that, I talked about some of the requirements, for example, deposit insurance. It doesn't exist in DeFi world. You know? So you have to have, the concept of deposit insurance can be applied in the digital environment as well. Of course, it has to be tweaked in a way, but that should be part of the process of accountability. Same with the reserve requirements, same with the requirements of capital requirements, all of them have to be there. And how you structured them, of course, that would be very nuanced to the industry or the new industry that is emerging. But if we say that, okay, these are not banks, or these are not bank-like institutions. Because, for example, one of the lessons from the, again, I always like history, 2008-9 crisis is that this is where I spent quite a bit of time. So we created an entity called QSPE. It was created by SEC. You know, SEC is a regulatory role, and there are many regulatory bodies in the US. And SEC basically said that for qualified special purpose entities, QSPEs, and the idea was the QSPEs where all the MBS were issued by QSPs. And QSPs didn't have meet the capital requirements. They're not even banks. They're not even non-bank financial institutions because they're not taking deposits. They're not taking. So every commercial bank, the large ones, they created QSPs. So they would first issue the mortgage. The mortgage would be then securitized. And after securitization, they would sell the mortgage to the QSP. And QSP would hold the mortgage, collect the payments, and then whatever they owe to other entities. So this entity was treated like they're not banks, they're not non-bank financial institutions, they're completely an arbitrary institution that wasn't regulated by in any possible way. And that created the subprime mortgage bubble that we saw in 2007 and starting from 2004-05 and in the bust in 2008. The reason, so we created that opportunity because the whole idea that banks, because in order to, and another problem at that time was that a role of the rating agencies. So what happened that if you had any mortgage securitized, if you had a triple rating of the securitized pool, then your capital requirement would be, even if you kept it on the balance sheet of the bank, your capital requirement would be as good as holding government securities. US Treasury and triple rated MBS were given the same capital requirement treatment. Even that was not good enough for banks. First of all, 97.9% of the MBS that were created were rated AAA level. You know, obviously they were not AAA. And then even that small capital requirement, which is basically 20% of the capital requirement, 20% meaning that, you know, if you had a capital requirement of $1 for those MBS, you had a 20-cent capital requirement. But still that was not enough. Banks still put everything on the QSPs, most of them. And that's where the problem is. So the capital requirement would be absolutely must for a DeFi environment to become more mainstream because you have to identify how would they meet the capital requirement? What would qualify as capital? That is a technical question that has to be understood because you cannot have entire capital requirement met through dollars or other existing assets. You have to give some weight to the new assets that are being created in the digital environment, whether they're NFTs, whether they are, you know, other stable coin type assets, or whether they are pure a digital, you know, a coin. And you have to have capital weights. For example, when you are holding cash, to me, that is your capital requirement is zero, right? You know, you don't have to set aside any capital for that when you're holding cash. But in other kinds of assets, you have to have a different liabilities, you have to have a different kind of capital, right? So you have to also have a tier of capitals based on the risk those assets represent. So risk-adjusted capital requirement would be extremely important for DeFi to take off and become more of a credible player in the marketplace.
Yeah, so there's this concept of embedded regulation that maybe we can get into the next episode, where effectively embedded in the actual smart contracts and the way that they work, you have an audit mechanism for regulators to go in and check, okay, is this stablecoin? What is it backed by? What are the percentages of what particular asset? How does it algorithmically trade? You know, so you actually have this ability to check whether or not you have this capital requirement or you have this backing, depending on the type of security or the type of platform that it is. I think the challenge is going to be coming. There was a great article in the Financial Times about this a few weeks ago, or maybe a week ago, on the regulator in the, you know, the European banking regulator, essentially concerned about their ability to find any staff for crypto, right? Because if you think about the staffing requirements for actually being able to check the capital reserves or being able to understand this, you're talking about engineers and data scientists that can earn 10 times as much working for a private company or creating these coins and going ahead of regulators, right? Yeah. So I'm a little bit, I don't think, maybe concern's not the right word, but I don't have a whole lot of faith that the regulators are going to be able to keep up with this environment over time.
Yeah, and that has always been the case. You know, when you have so much money in the private sector, regulators are always, unless the regulators basically use that as a launching pad and an revolving door environment. So they spend 3 years in SEC and then they leave and they get a cushy job in one of the big banks. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much to me for joining us. Always a pleasure to have you on. And next time we'll go even further into this.